welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. I presume that all of you who are listening have, at one time or another, noticed that within the greater animal kingdom, the female of our species has a curvaceous body shape visibly different from the body shape of the male Homo sapien. Why women have curves and how these curves reflect on other aspects of the lives of all of us is the topic of this edition of Radio Curious. We visit with Dr. David Bainbridge, professor of veterinary anatomy at the University of Cambridge in Cambridge, England. He's the author of Curvology, The Origins and Power of Female Body Shape. When Dr. David Bainbridge and I visited by phone from his home in England on March 6, 2015, I asked him, why is it that female humans are curvy?
Primate species where males and females look exactly the same. There are some gibbons, for example. And then you get species like the gorilla where the male's obviously a lot bigger. But the thing that I think is distinctive about human females is the deposition of fat. The way that they, the distinctively female shape in humans is obviously to have lots of subcutaneous fat, especially on the bottom, especially on the buttocks and on the thighs, but also on the breasts, and just generally under the skin, reducing muscle definition is a very obvious feature, a strange feature of the human species. And that's one of the things that made me want to look into all this. The reasons for this, we think, are to do with the unusual strain that's put on human mothers when they're bringing up their offspring. Human offspring, well, for a start, they take a very long time to grow up, but also they particularly need lots of energy and they need lots of particular fats, particular lipids, to build their brains. Human women basically lay down a depot of fat, of lipids, on their buttocks and their thighs, and that pretty much just stays there. It stays in situ. Women who try to lose that fat find it very difficult should they decide they want to. But the one time it suddenly seems to get mobilized is when a woman starts breastfeeding, which is when she really starts churning lots of calories into her baby. So we think that's probably the main reason why curves have evolved.
Well, in addition to that, there's the much wider hip on women than on men for birth purposes.
Yes, there is. I mean, I think this is probably one of the reasons why the fat, especially the curvy bits, have been put on the hips. Is that probably before the fat started getting laid down. The problem is we don't really know exactly when that happened because fat doesn't fossilize. But we think probably before that phase, the female hips were already wider. I mean, the pelvis is wider in most female animals. That isn't unique to humans. But it is sort of strikingly particularly wide in human women just because one of the ways that they produce babies with such big brains is that quite a lot of the extra brain growth goes on before birth. You know, probably about a third of the extra brain growth is prenatal, and so they have to produce these babies with big heads. And there was quite a lot of restructuring of the human pelvis that went on. For example, I mean, babies are now born, you know, kind of back to front. I trained as a vet, and I'm used to animals being born with their spine facing their mother's spine. But human babies are born kind of the other way around, with their belly facing their mother's spine, and their head goes through all these weird twists and contortions to actually come through the birth canal. And so there's a great deal of remodeling of that pelvis that went on. And I mean, in lots of ways, the pelvis is the defining feature of human women, partly because, of course, it had previously, even before that, been remodeled for standing upright as well in all humans.
In addition to the evolutionary development, there's the sexual selection. And I'd like you to compare the sexual selection, men choosing women, going back maybe 50,000, 100,000 years, if you know, to the current time when it is so heavily directed through commercial media.
Sexual selection is a strange thing whereby, I mean, natural selection is where traits are propagated and become more common because they're actually beneficial. But the sexual selection is when traits are propagated and become common just because the other sex seems to pick on them and select them and like them for some reason. So, you know, they're the sort of badges of health and fertility and genetic well-being. And so obviously an obvious famous example, of course, is the peacock's tail. If the female picks that as a cue of genetic health and vitality. And it appears that males, do the same thing with female curves. Of course, this isn't really a conscious thing. I mean, what's actually happened is over tens of thousands of human generations is the men that have sought out curves in women have tended to produce offspring who are healthy and intelligent and survived and would have their own offspring. And so that it just because of that, it's the men who've liked curves whose genes get passed on. And this is quite a powerful force. It can be very difficult to separate, you know, what's sexual selection and what's natural selection. We think very often actually both are going on at the same time. And I think that hard wiring, I think that's still there. I think that form of, you know, mate selection still goes on. I think the absolute size thing has changed. I think it's changed particularly over the last 100 years. I mean, it's quite hard to imagine what it was like, but I mean, 120 years ago and before that, it was pretty hard for anybody to get overweight. Most people were pretty slim. It does appear that, as I said, it's the ratios rather than the absolute size that men go for. Because, I mean, nowadays, of course, because there's much more food around, humans in general are a much wider range of sizes. Not shapes, but sizes. It is noticeable that men are actually not particularly fixed to wanting women to be a particular size. However, an appreciation of slimness in general seems to go across society, and it seems to be what happens when human populations become affluent, when they don't have to worry about where the next meal is coming from. And so you see it very much, you know, within human populations, the affluent people seem to value slimness more. And also over the economic cycles, when economic life is very good, and people are feeling very confident, the desire for slimness seems to increase as well. There's quite a lot of studies, you know, looking at sort of the shapes of Playboy models during boom and bust in economics.
Let's talk about pheromones. You've been focusing on the visual sense, but also there's the sense of smell. To what extent do you find that creates an attraction between male-female humans?
Smell is very important. It's probably more important for women's choice of men. This all started off with studies in rodents that showed very clearly that when a female was seeking a male mate, she would tend to seek out males who are genetically different from her. And it was quite clearly shown that this was based on smell related to quite a small set of genes that humans have. They're called the major histocompatibility complex. They're very, very important in the immune system, and they're very, very variable. And the fact that they're very, very variable in the population means that they're a good way for one animal to, if they can work out a way to detect them, it's a very good way for one animal to work out if another animal is genetically different from them. And it does. First of all, it's found that certainly female rodents could basically MHC type. They could work out what genes male animals carried, and they would, as I said, they would tend to select out genetically different males. Studying these sorts of things in humans is much harder, but what studies there have been do suggest that women, smell is very important for women selecting male partners, and they do tend to select male partners who are genetically different from them, probably by quite a similar system to what you see in rodents. The evidence of men selecting women on that basis is much weaker. It's been that there's very tentative evidence to show that it may happen. But it's much less important for men selecting women. So it kind of goes along with the sort of men being more visual creatures assumption, which we often make. So while pheromones are probably very important for women, they're probably less important for men. It's probably more on appearance and also assessing women's behavior as well. Behavior is something that's very important to men too.
Well, I want to talk about behavior, but let's stay with pheromones for a minute. Do you find in your research any evidence that men are subconsciously able to smell a different odor when a woman is ovulating?
Just in our one species, it seems as if women's fertility is kind of cryptic. It's hidden. It's hidden from women, and it's because of that. it's hidden from men. However, if you actually look at women, you do find that men can, to some extent, perhaps detect a change in pheromones around the time of fertility. And also, you know, there's all these studies about, you know, women wear different clothes around the time when they're most fertile. But these are very, very subtle findings. I mean, it's weird. It's not what you see in other animals at all. And it does imply that some of these things have been, you know, damped down in our species. So we can focus more on the visual, I suppose. And also the long term. Men don't particularly pick women because they're fertile right now. They pick them because they think they'll be fertile, you know, for the next 20 years.
I want to talk more about that, but first I want to say that we're visiting with David Bainbridge, the author of Curvology, The Origins and Power of the Female Body Shape. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Insecurity in women, focused on self-image. Can you address that in light of the commercialization?
Yes, insecurity is a strange feature of how women sort of think about their bodies. Many women do feel insecure about their bodies, certainly not all of them, but many of them do. I think this may go back to the fact that, 10,000 years ago, there weren't mirrors to look in. You couldn't see yourself as other people saw you. And also, we probably lived in quite small groups, small tribal groups, and so many women, they probably didn't see more than about 50 or 60 women in, for years at a time. Whereas obviously now we live in a very different world where the image, where images of women and women's bodies are around us all the time. Women, they obviously have to construct their own self-image of what they think is their own bodies, but it seems that they do it very much in the context of their own personality and what they see around them. And one thing I was particularly interested in was sort of addressing the assumptions we make about, say, the effects of media on women's opinions of their bodies, because we assume that it has a big effect. And what I try to do is I try to sort of pick apart the different aspects. How does exposure to particular images of women's bodies, how does it make women feel? Does it change the way they behave? It's things like you take little girls, and if they play with a very skinny doll like Barbie, they will actually eat less the next time they have a meal and things like that. So there's quite a lot of sort of quite clear-cut psychological experiments showing how things change. Another very striking one was getting women to fill out questionnaires about what they thought about their own body, how satisfied they were. And then you make them fill out a questionnaire after they'd watched either a sort of body makeover program or a house makeover program, and you can see that women's assessment of their own body declines pretty rapidly after they've watched the body makeover program. And rather alarmingly, you come back 2 weeks later and they still show a decrease in their body self-image compared to women who watched the house makeover program. So the evidence is really beginning to string together that it is the images that women see that seem to affect their beliefs about themselves. As I said in the book, there's one slight gap in the argument, which is that it would be nice to stick women in a brain scanner and study what their brain's doing as they're being shown images of other women's bodies. I mean, I think those experiments, I'm sure they'll be done within the next few years. I think I know what they'll probably show, but it's always nice, we make lots of assumptions about these things, but it's nice to see the evidence actually sort of, truly stacking up to support them.
Forecast for us, if you will, please, what you think that these images would show.
They've done similar things with if you show a woman a picture of her own body and then you distort the body in various ways to make it look larger or smaller. You see differences between the sexes, for a start, in men. You show them that, and the bits of the brain that react, bits of the brain that react to sort of the movement of bodies in space, visuospatial awareness, things like that. Whereas when a woman sees images of her own body being distorted in that way, it often sort of, the bits of the brain that are involved in fear and things like that are triggered in a way that they're not in men. So there seem to be fundamentally different sorts of responses to certainly their own body. And I think, it wouldn't be surprising if you saw a similar disparity between the sexes. I mean, there is variation in all of this. There's a subset of women where you show them pictures of very attractive women's bodies, and they actually feel better about themselves because they're already confident about their own body, and they look at those bodies and they think, oh yeah, mine's a bit like that. So it's important to say that, you know, the problem with all of this is it's based on averages, and there'll always be individuals who buck the trend.
You have an interesting section in your book, Curvology, about high heels worn by women, the reasons why, results of wearing them. You follow that with a comment about the quantity of pairs of shoes that women have compared to men.
Yes, I do. I mean, you survey these things, and they have, you know, huge numbers compared to men. Men, they can have sort of 10 or 20 times more pairs of shoes than the average man. Shoes have a strange sort of iconic status, really. I mean, especially if you go to very expensive women's shoe shops, and the shoes are sort of presented almost as fetish objects. They're almost like sculptures. Some of them, some of them look better off than actually on somebody's feet. But high heels is a very interesting thing. I mean, I write in the book quite a lot about clothes and what women are attempting to do to the appearance of their body with clothes. And there's been quite a lot of work done on high heels recently, because everybody always assumed that women wear high heels because it makes their bottom wiggle and makes them look very feminine. And the studies suggest that they don't particularly do that. One of the things that's been mentioned before is that women have to take shorter steps when they wear high heels, because they just do, just to keep themselves stable and stop themselves falling over. And we know that taking shorter steps, it's a characteristic of the female body anyway. So it could be argued that high heels are just accentuating the naturally short stride of women. I think there's got to be more to it than that, because women could just take short steps, really, couldn't they? And in fact, in many cultures, they do take exaggeratedly short steps. I think that many of these things are actually to accentuate the sort of the length and cylindricality, the straightness of the limbs. It's a bit like, long black gloves. Wearing high heels, it sort of straightens out the foot. It almost turns it into a segment of the leg, makes the legs seem straight and cylindrical. And, women have little feet. It's another very characteristic thing. They have relatively smaller feet than men. So anything that makes them look like they don't stick out forward, anything that makes the leg look longer and makes the foot look like it doesn't stick out so far forward, appears to be one of the enhancements that women do to their body. Despite the damage that high heels can do to your legs, I don't think they'll be going away anytime soon.
You point out what is perhaps an evolutionary aspect, or as well combined with sexual selection, of straight legs in women, indicating that they do not have a vitamin deficiency that would otherwise cause curvy limbs, and particularly legs.
Having straight legs was a big thing, because for much of human history, people have either been vitamin deficient, or inbred. There's been problems with inbreeding. And one of the things that does happen is that legs become bendy. Certainly in Britain 150 years ago, lots of people had rickets, vitamin D deficiency, when they were young, and it stayed with them all through their lives. And I think that's the reason why men are attracted to women with straight legs, is it means, well, not only is the woman healthy, it means she's got good genetic background, but it also means that when she was young, she was looked after well by her parents. She was fed well by her parents, and presumably the man's hope would be that she's inherited their good parenting genes. And this obsession with straight legs, it's even stayed on in our language. I mean, the word orthopedics means straight-legged children. So that whole field of musculoskeletal disease and medicine is based on the premise that people wanted their children to have straight legs. So it's easy to forget it now when nobody gets rickets anymore, but it was a huge thing until, surprisingly recently.
You mention a study that shows that women who react with greater insecurity to images of attractive female bodies tend to own more shoes. Why is that?
I just thought it was a great study to throw in, that they'd actually discovered that. I think this sort of ties in with my general thesis about appearance not just being appearance being a sort of integral part of how women think about themselves and how they think other people think of them as well, which the evidence shows is also the case, that they're right in that assumption, that people people make assumptions about women because of what they look like, what their bodies look like, and what clothes they wear. So I think what women are doing, I sort of describe it as the personal billboard, is every time they get dressed, you know, they're creating this this sort of advertisement to the world of you know, who they think they are and you know, what they think they mean and what they think their place in society is. And men do that, but not to nearly the same extent, I don't think.
There's an interesting bridge in what you just said about what women think others think of them. That's that silent interpretation, I presume, based on an observation of the other's body language as they view the one who is thinking about what the other person is thinking.
In the book, I write quite a lot about, you know, the idea that your body is sort of under surveillance. And, you know, even from quite a young age, there's two things that happen to girls. One is girls receive a lot more comments than boys about their body shape and what they wear and their appearance. I mean, for example, you know, early teenage girls receive lots of comments about that. If early teenage boys have their appearance commented on, it's usually in a very sort of simple way. It's like they're commenting that they're getting taller, you know, or something like that. Whereas girls realize that, you know, there's lots of different things about their bodies and their appearance which seem to be up for discussion in the world outside. The other thing is, even earlier than that, around the age of sort of five, girls are already learning that the body, their appearance, is something, you know, that can be modified. How you feel about your body, we're a social species. How they feel about your body is tied in with what other people appear to think about your body.
Do you have thoughts on the social reason why there are more comments towards young girls about how they look than boys?
Many feminists have said men are judged by what they do and women are judged by how they appear. There are probably biological reasons for why this is. They look at the basic reproductive biology is that than men. And you look back through history and there are many examples of, you know, heroic stories of men doing very well despite the fact that they were a bit ugly. Whereas, you know, you go back in Spain, you go back to, say, the Italian Renaissance, and where, you know, if a girl was born and she had a slightly, you know, wonky eye, she'd be put in a nunnery for the rest of her life. So it is a social thing, but I think it has biological roots.
I'm interested in the reception that you have received being a male, writing about these wide and sometimes very intimate issues concerning women.
It's been very interesting. I've had the sort of two diametrically opposed reactions to my book. I mean, most of the reviews to my book have been by women, and half of them say, you know, they think it's wonderful, it's made them think completely differently about their body and themselves. And the other half, first of all, they don't think these things should be part of sort of reductionist scientific study. That's one. And the others, I think, although they often don't say it explicitly, I think it's because I'm writing it as a man. Personally, I think writing it as a man actually, you know, it made it more interesting. I think it made me a lot more polite. Often when women are writing about what other women do, they can be very scathing in a way that I, you know, I just couldn't do as a man. The other thing that was very important is my editor, Laura Barber, she obviously is a woman from the name, and I think it's very important that a book like this goes through a female brain at some point before it hits the bookshelf.
I'm interested, David Bainbridge, in how you have been able to employ what you have learned in the research and writing of curvology as to how you raise your two daughters.
Well, this is an interesting question, because people often ask me about, you know, how do you relate it to your daughters? And the only thing I do is because I'm very aware that this strange thing that people comment more on girls' appearance, and also, you know, they comment more on, you know, what girls eat and how much girls eat, they worry about it more, is that I deliberately try not to comment on those two things to my daughters, and certainly not any more often than I would to my son. So that's the only thing I've really changed.
Well, David Bainbridge, author of Curvology, The Origins and Power of Female Body Shape, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I want to ask you a couple of questions about yourself, starting with a eureka or an aha moment in your life that gave you insight or changed your direction?
I think what it was, it came because all my degree and my previous training and all the biology I'd done at university was based on animals. I did a zoology degree. I trained as a vet. I did a PhD in working with reproduction in deer and things like that. And then I went to work actually in Oxford University, and I was working on human things. I deliberately made the break to work on human stuff for a while. And it was actually when I was driving to work one day and I was thinking about what I did, and I was thinking about writing a book, and I'd always assumed that humans were just another species. They were just another species like all the others, maybe a little bit weird. And I suddenly realized just how utterly weird our species is in so many, many ways. Brain, reproduction, social, the way we live our lives, all sorts of ways, the way we move. And it was that sheer weirdness of our own one single species suddenly hit me. And that's what drove me to start writing these books. And also, it's just been something that's fascinated me ever since, because it's just something that I'd never really realized. Well, I mean, like I said, I had all the information there, but I hadn't put it all together, I suppose.
And tell us, what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
That's a very good question. I think enjoying myself is very important. I love working at a university. I get to because I work at Cambridge University, I get to teach lots of really, really good students. I just love teaching, and I love sort of finding the right people. I'm involved with getting people into university and getting them fired up about things. So I'd like to do that for the rest of my life.
And finally, David Bainbridge, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
One book that I think really changed the way I thought about science was a book. The final version of it was called Intelligent Life in the Universe, and it was originally written by a Russian called Ivan Shklovsky, and extra examples were put in by Carl Sagan. And it came out in 1968, and it's about how we should think about the chances of finding intelligence out there in the universe. And what it is it's very thoroughly and very elegantly written, and it just showed me that if you really want to understand biology, you have to understand the science, the basic physical science, the physics, the chemistry, the maths. And it showed me that really how everything kind of slots together, how biology is a special kind of chemistry, and chemistry is a special kind of physics, and physics is the thing you use to predict the universe by using maths. It showed me how everything came together. It's as old as I am, that book, but it's still the best book in that field.
Well, David Bainbridge, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you very much.
Dr. David Bainbridge, professor of veterinary anatomy at the University of Cambridge in Cambridge, England, is the author of Curvology, The Origins and Power of Female Body Shape. The book he recommends is Intelligent Life in the Universe by I.S. Shklovsky and Carl Sagan, published in 1966. This program was recorded on March 6, 2015. There are over 500 editions of Radio Curious on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free to listen, download, and share as you wish. The email address is curious@radiocurious.org, and the phone is 707-462-6541. Christina Onnestad is the assistant producer, and I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.